Hello and welcome to Technology Today. This is your host, Rich Kasmer. On Technology Today, we discuss technology issues of the day and examine how technology is affecting our lives these days. And as I see every week, it seems to be having a bigger and bigger impact. And we're fortunate to have with us in the studio this evening, we have guest David Shookman. David is an information technology professional with 14 years experience as an IT manager in the transportation, financial services, and healthcare industries. And presently, David is an independent IT services training, policy, and management consultant. And David's been on the show before, and in the summer he was here, and we talked about blogging. So, David, welcome back.
Thanks, Rich. Nice to be back.
Yep. Thanks for being here. And today we're going to talk about one of David's blogging topics from a recent blog, which was passwords and password security. So, David, I'll let you introduce the topic, and we'll get into a conversation about passwords.
Sure, and it's actually a topic of what's more secure than your password. Passwords are really a very old technology, probably shortly after computers were first available and used by lots of people. But unfortunately, what we're finding is that passwords are now being easily hacked. So there are some alternatives, and that's what we'll talk about.
Okay, great. So what is it about passwords that has made their use less secure for user access?
Well, as I mentioned, it's an older technology. Certainly when computers were not interconnected the way they are now, and computers are certainly connected on the internet or through local networks. When they were just individual, passwords were probably a pretty good security mechanism to make sure that only you can access the system. But with the interconnectivity, it's opened it up to maybe hackers trying to get to systems or people stealing each other's access, and it's just not as secure as it used to be.
And what are some of the ways that hackers use to get access to the accounts of others?
What hackers will do is try and either steal passwords from corporate computer systems. We probably heard about breaches like at some of the department stores lately. I'm not going to name them, not to pick on them. But often what happens is information that's stored is compromised, including user IDs and passwords. So that could be one way that a hacker could steal the password. It could also be something as simple as somebody temporarily walks away from their desk, going to visit somebody, and while they're away, the computer is what it would be called unlocked or unavailable, and someone might just want to steal some information very quickly.
I know a lot of people have a trusty piece of paper in their desk with all their passwords written down. I guess even somebody could know where that is and get at those passwords.
There's a fellow that I knew at a former company, and he had a sticky note that he would put on his monitor so he would know the password for the primary system or to log on to the network. So certainly someone who is even in the custodial department in the evening would be able to have that access right away. Very unfortunate and innocent type of problem.
And the hackers, I've heard of cases where a virus might just be capturing keystrokes. And is that another method that is used to steal passwords?
Sure. Once the hacker has some sort of access, one of the common problems sometimes we hear about are we receive an email from someone we know, or at least we think that's who it's from. Probably that hacker stole a user ID and password, sent an email on behalf of that person using that ID, and embedding a link, and that link now opens up a Pandora's box of access.
And then we always see the articles listing the top 10 used passwords, you know, things like password and 1234 or 123456.
Yep.
I guess it's not necessarily stealing the password, but guessing it is just as dangerous.
Yeah, there's an organization called Splash Data. They do these sorts of analyses, and one of the things they've accumulated as the winner, or maybe the loser, for the worst password to use, the most common password is actually just the digits 123456. Mm-hmm. So that's the number one offender, or simple password of just guessing. Number two is the word password that people want to remember a password very easily, and they just use password, and those are not very strong passwords.
some of those robotic systems that will go in and try and guess a password. They're basically going to go through those types of combinations. Those little CAPTCHA series of letters and numbers that are hard to read, and you always have to enter it three times because you can't quite make it out. Those do help quite a bit, though, correct?
Yeah, the CAPTCHA codes, we see them a lot of times, maybe when we're doing online ordering. You see an image that contains some sort of letters and numbers, not just the letters and numbers, and it does become a lot harder for these automated programs to read or steal passwords or getting access to the system. That's a second level of validation.
And sometimes those things appear like stretched or curved because it's harder for a robotic virus
right,
to try
right.
and
steal sometimes
it.
We've noticed it's hard for us to read, but certainly yes. for a lot of computer systems, it's very hard for them to steal them as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So those are some of the issues. Maybe we could talk about some of the alternatives, but are there any other issues related to passwords that we want to touch on before we get into how to deal with it?
Well, surely if people get access illegally or improperly to your personal information or your PC, there's a lot of information that you have at risk. If you think about you do your online banking, if you keep financial information, personal information, it's really nobody else's business, but you risk exposing that to people that shouldn't be getting it.
So that information is probably stored somewhere on your computer if you've entered it somewhere along the way.
Sure, sure. There's all sorts of programs that we have on our computers. It could be as simple as a Word processor, an Excel spreadsheet. There are a lot of financial programs that people have. And once a hacker has the user ID and password or sufficiently guesses it, that information just opens up. It's almost as if you've left your house but left the door unlocked.
Okay. So before we talk about some alternatives to passwords, how about some of those programs that store your passwords and then you don't have to remember them all, but you have one password to get into that, and it enters your credentials?
There are a number of programs that are out there. Some of them you can buy and install on your own. Others are available on the Internet, and it becomes your one password. You do have to remember is the password or the means to access that system, but in it would be the list of user IDs and passwords and programs that they relate to. So for those people that do find the challenge remembering lots of different systems and passwords, especially on personal ones, that's a good option.
I do know that some of those work across devices, mm-hmm. so that if you have an account that you want to access from your computer, an account you want to access from your phone or tablet, it'll enter that information for you once you've entered the master password. But is there a danger to having that information? I assume it's stored in the cloud at that point somewhere. Is there a danger to having it stored in the cloud?
Well, we could spend a whole nother show talking about cloud security and issues around that. I don't think we really have time for that today. But there's always a concern. Make sure you pick a good cloud provider that you know is reputable or has that reputation of being good. What they should be doing is encrypting the data that they store to make it even harder for the hacker to find the data, even if they broke into the system.
Okay. Good advice. Okay, so let's turn our attention to alternatives to passwords. I know the first category that you mentioned to me when we were talking about the show this evening was biometrics. What are some examples of biometrics that would work?
So biometrics is basically leveraging some form of your real human characteristics or traits instead of just a manually entered password. Some of these are available to the regular retail user. A lot of these are geared towards corporate-type customers. And it could include a fingerprint scan. I know I have a laptop at home that has a fingerprint scanner, and I've used it once or twice for unlocking. And we all know that fingerprints are unique, like snowflakes. At least that's our understanding. It could be a palm print. There are devices that have, like, the outline of a hand that you would put your hand on, and the device would look for your palm print, you know, once it's recognized. Facial recognition, probably less used for the end user, but that's very common for Security, trying to find people in a crowd, but facial recognition is a way, is another way. Retinal pattern, a retina scan, which is the back of your eye. The thing that I always remember about the retina scan was the Star Trek II Wrath of Khan movie from about 30 years ago. Captain Kirk had to submit to a retinal scan to look at a secret file. And I just thought that was really cool. Mm-hmm. And there's even DNA as well, where they actually sample and probably like swab your cheek or take one hair to get the follicle, and they can analyze the DNA for a match, and it becomes a means of authentication. So that's biometrics, the biology of it.
Wow, interesting. I could just imagine trying to submit a DNA sample to make a purchase at Amazon.
Right, or your checkout line even at a supermarket when you're swiping your credit card.
Right.
You know, certainly swabbing your cheek or some of the other methods are a little bit invasive,
mm-hmm.
and some of them are even time-consuming because you may have to wait for the technician to get the long Q-tip and get the right spot and get it analyzed. But some of them are very quick. Swiping your finger or your palm, get a scan that way, could be really not very invasive.
Mm-hmm.
So it can be done a lot more quickly.
Yeah, I've seen a fair number of laptops over the years that have the fingerprint reading capability, but a lot of people don't ever activate it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a shame because it is so easy. You just swipe your finger across it and you gain access.
I think sometimes what happens is especially when it's our personal laptop, we think of it as safe because it's on our person.
Mm-hmm.
But you just never know if it was accidentally left in a public place. Somebody could get access to it.
Sure, absolutely. And I know that the new Apple Pay system that's just rolling out in the last month or two does use fingerprints as well, correct?
You know, I'm not an Apple person, so
oh, okay.
I don't use the Apple Pay.
Okay.
Like I mentioned earlier, I have an HP laptop that I use personally, and on the lower right side, there's a little fingerprint scanner. I just kind of swipe my finger top to bottom for those couple of applications, and
mm-hmm.
that's my authentication. Mm-hmm. If with my ID and your fingerprint, it wouldn't let you in.
You mentioned that there's a concern over the invasive nature of some of these methods. Are there also ethical concerns?
You know, I think that there are. I've read some articles about that, especially with the invasive type. If you're taking a sample of something from somebody, some people may think that the information being kept could be used for reasons other than that identification. So I think really as you plan the type of security mechanism or validation that you want to do, whether it's corporate or personal, you have to think about if there are any sort of external concerns, like if there's an ethical issue.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. David, any other reasons not to use biometrics?
Other than the ethical, I would say the other is some of them are a little bit time-consuming. And when you are using or need to process more quickly, that's probably when you would want to avoid some of the more time-consuming. Again, a retinal scan, you have to put your maybe in a chin rest or make sure you're in the visor properly, your eyes are held open for a period of time, really makes that, in some cases, inconvenient. I would think very, very secure places, they would tolerate that.
Any examples that you're aware of that use any of these other methods other than the fingerprint?
Well, the methods I mentioned are the main ones, I would say. I don't have any other examples handy.
Okay.
Not for the biometric.
Okay, that's fine. All right, I'll take a quick break here. Mention that you're listening to Technology Today with your host, Rich Kesmer. We're here on WDVR-FM 89.7 in Delaware Township. Translator station W220AG 91.9 in Lawrenceville, Princeton, and Trenton, New Jersey. And 90.5 WPNJ in Easton, PA. We also stream live on the web at wdvrfm.org. And tonight we are speaking with David Shookman about what you can do that might be more secure than using a password. And we just talked a bit about biometrics. I know David's got another category of FOB, key FOB or token. David, tell us about this category. How can this help with security?
Yeah, a key FOB or a FOB, not always a key FOB, but a FOB is a little device. Usually there's some sort of digital readout, small little pad that shows numbers. And it's a small hardware device. And it has built-in authentication in it. And it also typically synchronizes, the authentication method synchronizes with what's on the host server. And so this tends to be a fairly reliable means of security. And what happens with the authentication, the algorithm they have, every time interval, usually a minute or so, a code changes. So if you actually looked at your key fob for a period of time, you'll see the numeric or the alphanumeric code changes. And it changes at the same time and frequency with the same algorithm as the host system that's managing the security. So essentially, your password changes every minute or so. Hmm.
So what happens if the FOB is stolen? It's not usable on another system?
Generally not. Mm-hmm. And also, the installation is specific to that either application or system that you're trying to access. And plus, still, the person would need to know the user ID as well. But no, it wouldn't be available to use on another system. It has no application at all.
Okay. I'm aware of some programs that use something similar, at least it sounds like it, and it's called a dongle. Is it the same kind of thing?
Very similar, yeah. A dongle often has the connotation that it's a connected type of a fob. Maybe it plugs into a USB port or a specific port. Mm-hmm. Another kind of specific port might be a smart card, about the size of a credit card, and you slide it into a reader. Mm-hmm. And that connectivity needs to be there as well. So if that device was lost, since someone couldn't take it to another system where it's coded, it would also be fairly secure. It would be useless. So there are some fobs that are connected. And there are some that are a bit disconnected or separate, like the one with the numeric code.
Yeah, I'm familiar with a few people that have smart cards for access to some military systems. And some software packages I've seen require use of a dongle over the years.
Yep, sure. A lot of times the software companies use them for licensing as well. You need to keep the dongle in the server so that people can continue to use licensing. So there's a lot of means for security using a dongle-type approach.
Are there different types of fobs?
Sure. So, we did mention a little bit about the disconnected and the connected, and so that's basically broadly the categories. An extension of that might be like Bluetooth, where your device needs to be kind of within the radio frequency. A very common use for some of us would be to start your car. A lot of times cars now don't have the traditional key. Instead, you push a button, but the little fob needs to be within inside the car or very close in order to start the car. It's another example of that.
Hmm. Okay. Anything else you want to add about fobs?
No, I don't think so at this point.
Okay. And I know the other category that you wanted to cover was mobile devices. How can you use mobile devices to control user access?
The mobile devices, and sometimes they call it wearables, that's a technology that's also being brought to the retail use a lot more, people for their own personal use. It's really kind of a two-step approach. And what happens is you log into the application or the network that you want to log into. And once the system recognizes you, it's going to send a message to your smartphone or your phone. It could be a text message. It could be an email. And it will include a code. And the screen that you're logging into, you just put your ID, will be waiting for that very specific code. And usually what happens is it only gives you a minute or two. So if you don't get the email or text, you'll ask for another code. And so it becomes very secure. The code expires after a short period of time. But what becomes nice about that is it needs to be you using your phone or device to receive that message.
Is this what's part of what they call two-step verification?
And it becomes a two-step verification because mm-hmm. you are validating at your, let's say, your keyboard, you're putting in your user ID, sometimes even a password, and then it sends the code to you. And then you, the second step is enter that code in after you receive it. So it becomes very secure and very personal as well.
And many systems that we use daily now do have this in place, but a lot of people don't have it turned on, correct?
Yeah, I would think that's the case. Certainly, you know, for network access or programs that we're using, some things we turn on or don't turn on. And it's something that we could, just like you mentioned, some people have their laptops and don't turn on their fingerprint security if they don't want to. But when something needs to be a little bit more secure than just the password, this could be a very good option.
Okay, good. So, David, we covered a lot of ground on some alternatives to passwords. What can we do now to improve user security if we do not have these technologies?
Yeah, well, these technologies, some of them are just wonderful, but maybe the programs we're using don't yet have them installed, or maybe there's a cost for us to invest and we're just not ready to do that. So there's probably some good password policy that you can do on yourself for yourself. For example, we talked about the very poor passwords, like 123456, or the lowercase using just the word password. There are some really good tips. Microsoft and others have some tips out there. So I would say what you want to do, your password should be fairly long, at least 8 characters. Don't use a short password. Make sure that it doesn't contain your username, doesn't contain your name, your company name. Make sure it doesn't even contain complete words, because those are things that are very guessable and probably hackers are going to do on among their first tries. And when it comes time to changing your password, it's always a good idea to change the password to something significantly different. So if you had a password and it was San Francisco 1 and it was time to either replace it or update it, don't make it San Francisco 2. Pick something completely different. And of course, I use the word San Francisco, and that's probably words that you don't want to use. So when you start putting your password together, use a combination of uppercase characters with lowercase characters. Most of the software and the networks all recognize those separate. So mix them up. It makes it a little harder to guess the sequence that you put in. Also put some numbers. So this way the numbers also make it a little bit harder to guess. And also use, they're called special characters. They're kind of those characters, if you look at your keyboard, and they're above the numbers, and they include like the exclamation point, the dollar sign, the percent key, and so forth. Put some of those in. And of course, when we make passwords like that, they become hard to remember. So what I like to do is I like to find a word and then start finding strategic places to put numbers and special characters and mix in the upper and lower cases. So that unsafe password of password, what we may want to do is start with an uppercase P. Instead of the A, use that at sign, you know, like we put in our email address at gmail.com. It's an A with a circle around it, but it's a special character, so P at sign. And then maybe a lowercase s. And the number 5 looks a little bit like an S, so maybe the second S becomes the number 5. You could put a W and then maybe 0 for the letter O. So I think you kind of get what I'm talking about, that you can kind of mix up the special characters in the upper and lower case to make something very secure. And then in addition to that, just make sure you change your passwords pretty regularly. Probably every 30 to 60 days is a good rule of thumb.
Great. Well, David, thank you so much for sharing all that useful information. I really appreciate it. I'll give you a chance to provide any contact information that you'd like, information on how to get to your blog and things like that.
Well, great. Thank you. So as you introduced to your audience, I am an IT service provider. My website and my blog is called techtopicsforyou.com. It's spelled TechTopics, the number 4, the letter U. It actually makes a pretty good password, but I wouldn't reuse it.
Right.
So all one word, techtopicsforyou, com. And all of my contact information for email is there as well, and phone number. And I'd welcome anybody to contact me if they have an IT question or concern.
Great. David, thank you very much. I really appreciate it. This has been Technology Today with your host, Rich Kesmer. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next Tuesday, same time.